Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Bob Hoy from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He comments on the New York exchanges, gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash, Hilliard Macbeth, gives us his take on the new Canadian federal budget and what it means to housing affordability, immigration, and the oil and gas patch. Wolf Street's Wolf Richter checks in from San Francisco to tell us what inflation is really doing. He also chats about the auto market and U.S. real estate. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from American Manganese CEO and President Larry Ray. We'll talk to Bob Hoy right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, recycling trade publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Welcome to This Week in Money, Bob.
Yeah, well, here we are, Jim, and good to be with you.
Bob, the stock market's, again, rather choppy. I see the ones that trade technicals down, the Dow for basic materials up. Was that the story for the whole week?
Yeah, it's, markets are actually very precarious, and it's had a huge shock earlier in the year when, the war with Russia upon Ukraine. And then that set back the financial markets, but then because Ukraine is such a large grower of, wheat and corn and I guess all those kind of crops, it had a problem in the financial market. So you had since Biden took office, and there's been rising prices generally, and that was started by his first steps while in office was to shut down as much of oil and gas business in the United States as they could, where they could control. So that meant exploration, production expansion, and pipelines. So you've had a huge increase in crude oil prices and natural gas prices, and that then put prices up at the gas pumps way before the Russian invasion. And but then that then event made things even worse. Like you had a huge short squeeze in some of the base metals, particularly in nickel price. So the financial markets have been extremely volatile. And I'm very concerned about this because the speculation has been crazy, and some of the speculative stocks have been hit hard. I saw an index the other day of new issue stocks, IPOs from a year ago, and it hasn't been a very good experience. So the other thing is the bond market, because of rising prices, this return of consumer price inflation never does the bonds a favor. So you've had interest rates rising for both high-grade treasury bonds and as well as lower-grade junk bonds. So the interest rate side has been distressed as well. So, and one of the things that, when the markets get this precarious, you wonder just how long they can stay good. And the hit earlier in the year was very fast and quick because it was on extremely bad news. And also the market had become vulnerable to bad news. So anyways, here we are. The markets may be sideways to slightly up until into perhaps May. This would be based upon a seasonal improvement in copper, lumber, and a few other commodities. But then after mid-year, things can turn seasonally bad. So we're looking at precarious financial markets now. And then one of the things within the stock market itself that's important are the what we call the breadth or the strength of the market internally. And you measure that with the advanced decline line. And in a bull market, most stocks are going up. And then when you get close to the top, that begins to change. And so your advanced decline line reached its best in November and has really quite broken down. Another index we look at is the New York Stock Exchange Composite. There's about 1,500 stocks in there, and it set its high in January, and while not broken down, the two relief rallies since its high have been lower than the big high. So this is a little concerning. And then that's internals. The internally, the stock market is not healthy. And then you've got some external forces out there, and one of them is in the credit markets. And in the last few weeks, there's been quite a bit of reporting about the yield curve inverting. And what this is where you take, for example, long-term Government of Canada bonds relative to T-bills, or as we always follow it in the States, long-term treasuries relative to T-bills. And one of the things you get as a business and credit cycle matures is that short rates, there's a huge increase for speculative money, which drives short rates up. And when short rates rise and become higher than long rates, the term is the yield curve is inverted. I know it sounds fascinating, but anyways. So our work on the yield curve, and anybody can do it, of course, is we go back in history a long ways, and the rule is very simple. When the curve inverts, you eventually end up with a recession. And in the great bubble of 1929, the curve inverted twice, and then you went through the contraction. So we've now recently, various portions of the yield curve have become inverted. So the signal is there, and you can't quite remove it. Another one that influences eventually stock prices are credit spreads, which is the difference between high-grade and low-grade bonds. And they have been beneficial lately with credit spreads narrowing. So that's been a plus for the stock market, although the stock market isn't really a huge winner. But nonetheless, one of these important items has been supportive. And but then that seasonally narrowing spreads can go into May or June and then reverse. So what we have, Jim, by way of a wrap-up, is the markets have been the most recklessly speculative in history. And you've had previous great financial bubbles going way back. You've also had central bankers, whether in Canada or the U.S., also acting in highly speculative financial fashion, that with the policy shutdown for COVID of a whole bunch of the global economy, and then they all went crazy and flooded the money markets with all kinds of short-term money, which then is now coming into inflation. So everybody in a great financial bubble gets reckless, and that's from private investors, private speculators, and also central bankers who really are speculative with their theories. So we're going to wrap this up, Jim, by saying the financial markets may be past their best for the bull market and could be working towards a bear market And that's strictly looking at the stocks. And then when you look at the yield curve and credit spreads, it's sort of on path for a change as well. So our advice to people is to use the rallies to take some liquidity out of the financial markets. And it's always difficult to get out of a market that's been making lots of money, but it takes a little discipline.
Bob, what's going on in the crude market?
Yep. Again, the games being played with the inflationary credit policies going on and the Biden administration shutting down as best they could the oil and gas business in the U.S., it's been up. But it could have reached a crisis level earlier in March, and our technical indicators became extremely overbought. As a matter of fact, with the CRB commodities index, the most overbought since the cyclical peaks in 2008 and 2011. So a large part of the fact that commodities are going to go up forever is in the market, and including the crude oil with that.
Gold, what's it doing?
Yeah, it's had some good innings through the year so far. And the counter trade in the markets has always been gold. We look at gold's real price, and it comes down in a great financial bubble, and it has. Gold stocks underperform the S&P, and it has. But we think that both the real price of gold and gold stocks are getting set up for a major buy in probably maybe after August and maybe into October if there's some problems. But then this would set up a multi-year bull market for the gold sector. And then for ordinary investors, if you go out of the equities and into cash or bank deposits or CDs, the treasury bills, the yield will soon be next to nothing. And so our advice is to find some good quality corporate bonds, maybe in about a 4-year term maturity, and you can get a higher yield out of them than out of cash. And then if we're in Canada, if you find some U.S. corporate bonds, then you will get the extra pickup from U.S. dollar firming relative to the Canadian. So there are some places to go in a storm. But again, it's also difficult as well.
Bob, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you. And it was an interesting week in the markets.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy, the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. Coming up, Hilliard Macbeth, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
Great to be on the show.
Hilliard, will the federal 2022 budget likely affect real estate?
Well, it's going to affect it in a small way, but you know, they weren't very bold. They took very cautious steps. You know, one of the bigger things is the banning of foreign buyers coming in to transact. But then there's a whole list of exemptions. Like if you say you're buying it for recreational purposes, then you're exempt. And of course, we know about the exemption of having a child that's going to school here or something. Well, that would still be in place. So it's not going to have a huge impact. And on the demand side, they did a couple of small things, establishing a new tax deducted, kind of like an RRSP for saving up for home ownership. But the maximum is $8,000 a year, and it doesn't even start until next year. So it's in 5 years, somebody will have $40,000 inside there. That's hardly going to be enough to give them a down payment for anything in Canada.
I also saw something in the federal budget about a $500 credit. That won't even buy a window in a house.
That's to ease the stress of real estate being unaffordable, I think is what he said. So, I mean, I shouldn't be laughing, but it goes back to, probably people will remember the Harper budget years ago when they brought in the TFSA. And, I know people like the TFSAs and all that, but really, there was a much simpler way to do that. We used to have a $100,000 exemption on all capital gains for anything, whether it be speculation in stocks or real estate or whatever. And the CRA kept track of it. You didn't have to open an account. You didn't have to do all those special tracking of everything. And that would be so much simpler. And it's the same with housing, but these little gimmicks that people seem to want to do, it's probably because the politicians want to be seen to be doing something, but all it does is create a whole bunch more paperwork and bureaucracy for the people that have to administer it.
Yes, we have a federal government that also wants to radically increase migration to Canada, but at the same time, you're banning foreign buyers of homes. Isn't that a contradictory policy?
I guess once they're here, they wouldn't be considered foreign. I mean, there's this whole thing about temporary workers and non-permanent residents, and then people becoming permanent residents. So a lot of those 400,000 that they're talking about would perhaps already be here. They might have already bought a home as a non-permanent resident that they would be allowed to. So it's not as big a deal as it sounds. Like a lot of these things are not as big a deal as they sound. For instance, there's 38 million people in Canada, and 1% of that is 380,000. So 400,000 is just a little bit over 1%. And that's not that big an amount, especially now that our population is not really growing through the normal birth-death method of calculating it. So in the last census that came out, the growth rate, even with all the immigration that they've been promoting, was quite a bit lower than in the past. So it won't have that much effect. It's a continuation of things more as normal. The one new thing that was in the budget, it's quite new, is the tax on profits for banks. That was, although they telegraphed it ahead of time, and it turned out to be half the size that they had hinted at, that's actually pretty new. There isn't anything like that in the system right now. So that's there were obviously a lot of complaints from the bankers about that, but I don't think the average person is going to be against that.
Also, banning foreign buyers. Now, in Vancouver and Toronto, back in 2016, 2017, foreign buyers were a major factor in the real estate market. But according to a friend of the show, Ross Kay, foreign buyers haven't been much of a factor the last few years because, A, you couldn't get into Canada because of the COVID restrictions, and B, Canadian real estate is just too expensive for them.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of speculators among the foreign buyers, and once they sense that it's gotten too expensive and it's likely to drop more than it's going to go up, they might move on. They might move on to Seattle or some other place like that. And you know, the biggest correlation with rising house prices would be creation of new jobs and new employment, and that's just not happening in Canada. So we can bring in as many immigrants as we want, but if we're not creating the jobs, it's not going to work to increase house prices, and of course, increasing house prices in the current environment is a terrible goal anyway. we should be putting more money into research and development and new ideas for new entrepreneurial pursuits rather than just tying up a bunch of money in speculating on real estate.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, there aren't any rules on who can lend money for mortgages, and because of that, I've heard there's no effort or will by the Canadian government or provincial governments to go after money laundering. And so if you got a big load of cash, nothing like mortgaging your own home to launder that cash.
Yeah, well, mortgaging the equity in your own home through a HELOC or some other kind of loan, and then buying more real estate has become a Canadian pastime. It's like what people, whether they do it for their own kids or whether they just do it to try and make money, it's become quite common. And, of course, it's just going to lead people into terrible trouble if house prices ever stop going up. And, you remember you mentioned 2016, 2017, they brought in some taxation against foreign buyers, and there was actually a fairly significant lull in the housing market after that, although the market managed to get over that. But on the money laundering, the Cullen Commission was going to issue its second report, its final report. I think it would have been out by now. And they asked for an extension, I think, till April or May. This is April already. May, I think. So it's coming out pretty soon, and it's going to be pretty big deal. One of the major chartered banks mentioned it in their report on the budget. So it may be that the budget is not the right place to talk about money laundering, but the government may be planning to do something about it. It's the same problem as a lot of these initiatives for housing, though, and that is that a lot of it is provincial jurisdiction, not federal jurisdiction. So the federal government can talk about doing something about money laundering and changing the rules for housing, but unless the provinces are on side and willing to cooperate, probably nothing's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Also, Canada had something like $50 billion in outstanding taxes owed, but it's mostly by well-off people and who are very clever and hire accountants to hide that money, perhaps legally, perhaps illegally. I didn't see any expansion to the CRA to go after that cash.
No, CRA likes to beat up on a little guy because they don't like get into these long, it's only the really wealthy people that have the money to fight the CRA with lawyers and stuff, and they do fight. So the difference between tax avoidance, which is legal, and tax evasion, which is illegal, is a very fine line. There's a whole industry out there that is specialized in helping that. But I don't know. It's the other thing that was a bit of a disappointment about the budget was, because you and I have talked about my Tesla before and renewable energy and clean energy. I thought there would be more in there on that. There's a little bit of an incentive, but it's very tiny. And again, it might be provincial jurisdiction versus federal jurisdiction. I don't know, but I'm a little bit surprised. And they're also tiptoeing a bit around the oil and gas industry because they put in some pretty big subsidies for carbon capture. The problem there is, of course, to capture the carbon from the oil and gas industry, you have to keep producing the fossil fuels. So the more serious environmentalists don't think that carbon capture is, they think it's a bad idea because all it does is allow the continuation of production of fossil fuels. And the second problem with carbon capture is that there's no proof that it works. The people that have tried it have been unable to do it very successfully. So now maybe more money from the federal government going into research and development and on it may achieve a breakthrough. But at the moment, the carbon capture systems are not that great. So that was actually a pretty big initiative in there. I think that one plus the tax on banks was probably the two biggest initiatives. There was also some other stuff in healthcare, and they're talking about pharmacare and dental care and that stuff that hasn't quite ready to launch yet. But I think the people that were hoping for a more progressive budget, whether it be in social service type things like healthcare and pharmacare and dental care, would be disappointed. And the people that were hoping that something would be done more about renewable energy, they'll also be disappointed. And then, of course, all the people that have bank shares will be upset about the taxes. So It wasn't really a budget that's. They're obviously not getting ready for an election. Let's put it that way.
Would you call this a wealth distribution and climate change budget?
No, I don't think they went. They didn't go very far at all on those files. It was a very tiptoey kind of thing, and they also seemed to put a big emphasis on cutting spending, almost like they were doing the conservative route, you know, the conservative party route. Say, well, we have to get our budget balanced. No, the budget deficit in the 2020 was something like $350 billion, and then this year it's going to be just over $100 billion, $113 or something, and the forecast for next year is about $50 billion. So it's still pretty big, but inflation is really helping the government. So the government gets paid based on incomes, and GST gets paid on the sale price of goods. And it goes up automatically with inflation, so they got a pretty big windfall there. So the deficit may come down faster than people previously expected, and some people are really upset about that deficit. But I think inflation is a much bigger problem.
Could increasing inflation and increasing interest rates wipe out the budget projections?
Yeah, the increasing inflation and increasing interest rates. They were not really mentioned much in what I saw in the budget. Although I didn't read all 268 pages yet, but this is the big thing. I mean, I was just talking this morning to some people in the construction industry in Vancouver, and you try and get a bid for a project, it's only good. It used to be good for a month, and now it's sort of like day to day, almost hour to hour in terms of the cost of things. And of course, none of them know. The materials cost is maybe half the cost. The other half is labor. None of them really know what's going to happen with labor. So it's very difficult to bid a project and get approval for a project and complete a project on the Trans Mountain expansion, for example, is a good example. It's going, they're going full speed ahead. But the thing started out at $9 billion, and I think now it's at $21 billion. So how do you try and, you know, as a private sector operator, how do you try and do something in that environment? It's you could be putting your whole company completely at risk if there's a cost overrun. So people try and build in protections and guarantees and all that, but those guarantees don't always work. You know, this thing about a fixed price contract, well, you know, 6 months later, the guy's back at your door asking to renegotiate. And if you don't renegotiate with him, then he says, well, I'll just go bankrupt then. And then where will that leave your project?
The coalition Liberal NDP government focuses on debt to GDP and is planning to spend and spend in deficit at least until the 2026-2027 fiscal year. Could this be part of a plan by members of the World Economic Forum to bankrupt Canada in line with Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, where you will own nothing and be happy?
Be happy. Just don't worry. Be happy. Well, I don't know about the World Economic Forum. I've seen stuff written on that, but certainly, the federal government is not in any kind of trouble in their spending. They're at 45% of GDP. They used to be at 30% of GDP, with the modest, projections for growth. They're expecting it'll come down to 41%. So, you know, when they announced spending, just to give some example, I think the number for housing was $5 or $10 billion, but it's spread over several years. When people start throwing numbers in the billions around, nobody understands, or almost nobody understands what that means. So just to give you an idea, the GDP of Canada is about, let's just say, $2 trillion. It's a little bit off that, but it makes the math easy. 10% of $2 trillion is $200 billion. That's how much Canadians spend in investment into residential real estate every year is about 10%. It's one of the highest in the world, if not the highest. And to give you an idea, the peak in the U.S. was 6%. We're at 10%. So $200 billion a year, and that's new homes, renovations, all the costs of doing business, that sort of thing. Well, so $5 or $10 billion against $200 billion is just nothing. It's just a tiny, tiny amount. But when they announce it, it looks like it's a large amount because nobody knows how much $5 or $10 billion is. The biggest number in the budget was the $16.5 billion that's a tax on the banks, a one-time tax of $15 billion, and then a 1.5% per year tax, which is about another $1.5 billion. So $16 billion in the first year, $16.5 billion, something like that. So that's a fairly big number, but it's still a tiny fraction of $200 billion, which is how much Canadians are putting into residential real estate every year.
The coalition government is planning to raise immigration to 451,000 per year. The 2022 Canadian federal budget dropped on Thursday. What did you like and what didn't you like about the budget?
Well, I didn't really like very much of the budget. It's like, you know, I think the it's a bunch of little things, but really they didn't go far enough on really anything. And some of the stuff is you know, the good news was, in terms of not doing very much, is they didn't change any of the tax rates and the like there was a rumor they were going to bring in the capital gains and make it the 50% exemption less attractive on capital gains. But to give an example, they put in a thing about if you buy a house and sell it within a year, that would be flipping, right? Speculation in housing, which is people claim the principal residence on that and they don't pay any tax on that. Well, that's not right, probably. That's probably not the intention of the exemption for principal residence. You're supposed to live in there for quite a while and then you get an exemption on the gain. So, they brought in a 12-month thing, but then they've got all these exemptions, which I'm sure creative people will find a way to find a loophole that they can slot their situation into. So they could have been much more aggressive, I think, on some of that stuff. If we really decide we don't want to do this stuff, if we really decide that these things are wrong, then take a fairly bold action and create. So this thing, it won't create any very much controversy at all. The biggest complaint will be from the very powerful charter banks because of this new tax.
Hilliard, is this increased immigration good or bad for Canada?
Well, first of all, let's just understand that it's not really that big an increase. It's, you know, they've been coming along at, you know, 1%. They've been trying to. Secondly, there's no guarantee they're going to accomplish. They put out a number, 400,000. And, will they achieve it? You know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these people are already here. It's just converting them from non-permanent residents to permanent residents. A lot of them might choose to go home if the jobs are not there. They may not stay, so they may not be able to reach that target at all. But the main thing is the jobs. It's not the immigration, it's the jobs. Are they going to be able to create jobs for these people to have a happy, successful life in Canada and be productive members of society? Because what's the point of immigration if you can't find good jobs for them?
Stopping foreign buyers of homes with a number of loopholes for 2 years, is this likely to have much effect on the housing market?
Not the way they've done it. The closing of the loopholes is very, very timid. And one of the things that I think, and I think it's in the works, but it's more of a provincial initiative than a federal initiative. And the federal government may be working on this, but is the identification of beneficial owners of all these trusts and numbered companies and that sort of thing. If they require that, if they absolutely get very, very aggressive about that and, you know, put some people in jail over it, to set an example, once they do that, that'll have a bigger impact than any tax, because the money laundering money does not want to be identified. That's the number one requirement. Now, it doesn't solve the problem. It solves the problem for Canada, because once we insist on full identification, full disclosure, which is the way it should be, they just won't want to go through that identification process, and they'll just go elsewhere. So they'll find another place to launder their money, and it just won't be Canada. But that would be very positive for the real estate market, and we need to get prices down, and that would be the best thing they could do. So when this Cullen Commission comes out in a month or two, hopefully that'll be enough to get them to take action on that.
The Liberal NDP coalition is planning to increase taxes on banks and insurance companies, even though these costs would likely be passed on to the consumer. Is this the government biting the hand that feeds them?
Well, the government and the banks are basically joined to the hip. They're very, very closely tied. And of course, the profits from the banks are in some years, they're more than half of all the profits made by all the companies listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So it's a very significant amount of money. And most of that money, most of that profit comes from lending to households, either mortgages or HELOCs or credit cards or whatever, car loans. And the government is very involved in backstopping the banks if anything were to go wrong. So the banks have become more and more aggressive in lending to keep the housing bubble going. So as the house prices get bigger, the mortgages get bigger. And that's, you know, the mortgages recently have been growing at 10% per year. So it makes perfect sense for the government to turn around and say, you know what, you guys are making so much money off of this situation that basically the government has helped create for them, and they're certainly backstopped any losses if something were to go wrong. So why should the banks get to keep all the profits and the government get no, when the government's probably taking more risk than the banks are, why shouldn't the government participate a little bit more in that? But it's a pretty minor, amount of money, $16.5 billion compared to the size of the profits of the banks, and the size of the banks is tiny. The total mortgages outstanding, for example, are $1.7 trillion. So the size is just enormous. And, you know, people don't really realize how big this is. I've been talking about it for a long time. I'm sure people are tired of hearing it, but it's an enormous number.
In the budget plans, removal of flow-through investments in the oil and gas and coal industries March 31st, 2023. What could this do to oil and gas and coal in Canada?
Well, on the oil and gas side, just to take the first one, investors in worldwide are starting to turn away from investing in oil and gas. So the companies don't really have a problem with attracting investment now because their cash flow is, with $100 oil, their cash flow is enormous. They're even able to, you know, buy back their own shares and pay very generous dividends. So they don't need new money in the oil and gas industry. The unfortunate thing, if that goes ahead, the unfortunate thing is in the mining side, because there's a tremendous opportunity for Canada to become a supplier of the materials that go into batteries for electric vehicles. So that's going to become a huge business. Nickel in Sudbury, for example, is going to make a huge comeback. Tesla's just signed a deal with the owner of the former Inco Mines, called Vale. It's a Brazilian company. And there's a whole lot more development that could be done in many provinces in Canada. BC would be a big beneficiary, Quebec, on Northern Ontario. So that one could be a negative. But I suspect that they're probably going to replace it with something else that would be perhaps a similar but just a little bit different approach on it.
Your book is When the Bubble Bursts, Are You Seeing Signs of the Housing Bubble Bursting?
You know, I've heard anecdotally, but, you know, this has happened before, and it just seems to keep going higher and higher. But the one thing that is happening now that is different from any time in the last 5 years that you and I have been talking about this is interest rates are rising, and they're rising very quickly. In fact, the government bond, which is obviously not the same as borrowing money to buy a house, that's mortgages, but the government bond in the U.S., which is kind of what we have to follow, the U.S., the yields have gone up faster than at any time since 1994 when records were first kept. So this is a huge change. I mean, the 10-year government bond in the U.S. is approaching 3%, and it's very similar in Canada. And inflation, of course, in Canada is over 5%, probably more like 7%. And inflation in the U.S. is close to 8%. So one of the things that happens when mortgage rates go up is they're obviously already starting to go up because they're starting to climb higher with the bond rates, is that inflation actually looks to be greater because it's one of the key inputs into calculating the CPI is mortgage rates, because that's your monthly cost of buying a house. So under the shelter cost in CPI, the mortgage interest rate is a big component of that, and the higher the mortgage interest rate, the higher the inflation number. So we're going to see inflation rise quite rapidly in Canada, and that would be I remember hearing 7 years ago now, before my first edition of my book came out, people saying to me that the only way this housing bubble will burst is if interest rates rise. And I kind of argued with that a little bit. I said, no, it could, you know, the housing bubble could burst if there's a recession or something. Well, turned out I was wrong about that. We've had a couple of recessions, and the government stepped right in as soon as the recession hit and supplied so much money that the bubble didn't burst in the recession. But with higher interest rates, and especially with this amount of debt that people have accumulated, that may be the straw that broke the camel's back.
How prevalent are HELOCs, and what happens to them as interest rates rise and home prices drop?
So HELOCs are sort of like a mortgage, although they're a little bit different. And usually somebody has a mortgage, and then on top of it, they have a HELOC. And they're very prevalent in Canada, although the numbers, I mentioned the number a minute ago, 1.7 trillion for mortgages, and HELOCs are more like $300 or $400 billion. So they're a small fraction of the mortgage market. But they do tend to be more sensitive to interest rates because, unlike the mortgage, interest rate usually on the HELOC will go up immediately. As soon as the bank raises its prime rate, the interest rate on the HELOC goes up. So one of the things that people have done is they've used this equity in their home, along the lines of the Bank of Nova Scotia slogan, you're richer than you think. You have all this equity and you can tap into it by borrowing against it and buy another property or something. And that, for that, they use the HELOC. And, that could be a very dangerous, concoction. Higher interest rates could trigger quite a difficult situation for some people that have done that. My friends in the bankruptcy, business tell me that a typical homeowner comes in with more debt than a renter because the temptation to borrow against the home equity is just too great, and they go and they take out a HELOC and they get themselves into trouble. So as homeowners, they should be in better condition, but it turns out because of the very easy way of borrowing against the equity in the home, they end up in bigger trouble than a renter would be.
What needs to be done to get inflation under control?
So the way that this is a really good question. The way that inflation gets back under control through the method of the central bank. So basically, nobody wants to do the difficult job. So it's the central bank is the one entity that purports to have the tools. I mean, all of the central bank governors in Canada, the U.S., elsewhere have stated that it's okay if inflation runs hot for a little while. This is going back a couple of years because we have the tools to get it back under control. They never tell you what the tools are, but they tell you they have the tools. Well, it turns out that the tools they have really comes down to one tool, and the way it works is very brutal. So what the one tool they have is interest rates, and they can raise interest rates, they can push interest rates higher, as happened in 1979, 1980 with Paul Volcker of the U.S. Federal Reserve, and eventually interest rates peaked out at 20%, and there's a horrific recession and a very big crash in housing. And the way it worked is, it isn't the higher interest rates that does it. In fact, initially the higher interest rates caused inflation to go higher, because of the way inflation is calculated. The way the mechanism works is they have to trigger a recession. And that's what causes house prices and other factors that contribute to inflation to go lower instead of higher. So it's a very, very blunt tool, and nobody wants to do it. Nobody wants to trigger it isn't just a mild recession. It has to be a pretty severe recession to get people to get off the inflation bandwagon. So, but that's the only tool the central bank has, and we're about to find out, and I'm skeptical actually, we're about to find out if they actually have the backbone to go ahead and use it.
Do you have possible targets for price drops in real estate and a time frame?
So, I was asked to present to the House of Commons Finance Committee, I did that about a week and a half ago, and, in that, I explained that about how the inflation for CPI and the inflation for shelter has diverged. So the CPI has only gone up about, let's just say roughly double. It's not quite right, but it's close enough since 2000. So 22 years, the CPI index has doubled. As you know, and as everybody listening to this knows, house prices have gone up way more than that. In Toronto and Vancouver, it's fivefold, and in the rest of Canada, it's 4 to 4.5-fold increase. So for house prices to get back into line with wages and inflation and everything else, there would have to be a 50% reduction from the current prices back to the trend line where they would match up with regular inflation and regular wages and that sort of thing. So that would be the magnitude of the correction. And given that I've been so early on my call about the bubble bursting, I don't want to give a time frame because I've lost the privilege of being allowed to make predictions based on when it's going to happen. But I still do predict it will happen, and when it does happen, it'll be a financial crisis.
Hilliard, any other thoughts here on the federal budget and what you would have liked to have seen in it to perhaps make housing just a little more affordable for Canadians?
You know, I think they should have, we talked for a minute ago about the expansion of mortgage debt in Canada, and of course that feeds into the debt, and that's what will feed into the financial crisis. And I think they should have tackled that But of course, I understand why they didn't want to. It's a huge problem. I mean, what do you do? You give, one of my friends in the economics, a very brilliant economist, Steve Keen is his name, is suggesting we have a debt jubilee where we forgive the debts of people that are overly indebted. But I don't think that can fly politically. So I don't know how you do it, but somehow, instead of just taxing the banks, 1.5% or something like that, which really they won't even notice, what you do is you rein in their ability to give these massive loans to young people. And that'll cause house prices to come down, because the only way the house prices can keep going up is with the additional borrowed money that people have in their pocket to go and buy. And so that is the one thing that I wish they tackled, but I understand why they didn't want to.
Hilliard, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Bursts, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. You can check out his website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. He was speaking to us from a mountain somewhere in Whistler, B.C. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Wolf Richter, publisher of WallStreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to This Week in Money, Wolf.
Thanks for having me back.
Wolf, what do you think the real rate of inflation is?
Oh, boy. You know, my inflation rate here is very different from my friend's inflation rate in Tulsa, and a poor person's inflation rate, a low-income person, you know, a household, is a lot different than a high-income household inflation rate. So it is an incredibly difficult thing to measure, and because it's different for everybody. And so now that we have these national averages, and they don't really fit any particular household. And,
Wolf, I was just going to say, the average family's got 2.3 children, 1.9 pets. So, yeah.
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
Nobody's average.
And where does the average family live? They all live in the same place, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's a very difficult thing to measure and to average out. And so what they have found now, and this is interesting because this comes from a Fed governor Brainard, who is sitting on the policymaking board and is the second in charge there now. And so she's pointing out that actually there are systematic differences in how people across the income spectrum buy, so their basket of goods is systematically different, and high income households spend a lot more money. So given the proportion of the consumer price index, how it's focused on the quantities of each item that people buy, well, the high income households are much more represented in the consumer price index because of this, because they're buying more stuff, and so they're more heavily represented. So the consumer price index is measuring systematically more the inflation rates of higher income households, and it's measuring in a smaller proportion the inflation rates of the lower income households. But it's the lower income households that experience the most inflation. Number one, they're spending nearly all of their income on necessities. So they can't buy less. They have to they have to pay rent, and they have to make the mortgage payment, and they have to buy food and gasoline and all these other things to just get by. They can't not buy something, or they cannot buy less of something. So that's one thing. They cannot dodge inflation or price increases. They're exposed to them, and they're spending all the money on it. And number two, she said, is, and that's true, you know, they're already buying the lowest cost items on the shelf. So, for example, you can buy different kinds of cereal, and that's, you know, high dollar cereal and nice brands. And then it's, somewhere, the bottom is the store brand, and it's the lowest cost. Well, the lower income households are already buying the lowest cost cereal on the shelf. So when cereal prices jump as they have, then a higher income household can either just ignore it because they have enough income, or they can shift down. They can buy a lower brand. But the lower income household is already buying the lowest brand, lowest cost brand or the store brand. They cannot shift down further. They cannot go down the ladder. They're already buying the lowest cost items. And, they just are fully exposed to the full brunt of the price increases. And they're, so they're experiencing an inflation that is substantially higher than the national averages. Whereas, higher income households are experiencing inflation that is substantially lower than the national average. And this is a huge problem, you know, in how we figure monetary policies and all kinds of things, you know, because we don't really know how badly a lot of the lower income households are feeling inflation. We don't track this, you know, we don't have any data on this. We only have the national averages that are skewed towards the higher income households. And yeah, that's why there's so much unhappiness with this economy at the lower income levels, because yeah, they're getting wage raises, they're 5, 6, 7, 8%, but their inflation rates, their personal inflation rates, are much higher than that. So they're excited about their wage increase, and then they go to the grocery store, or they fill up the car with gas, or they get the rent increase, and bam, there it is, the wage increase is gone plus some. And that's a huge problem we have, and we don't know how to quantify it. You know, I don't know what the national average inflation rate should be. From where I sit, you know, with our income levels and spending levels, it looks pretty reasonable. In San Francisco, inflation is lower than in other parts of the country right now, because we've had this huge surge in price increases in housing and in rents and all those things, and they have now slowed. You know, we have, rents have come down a whole bunch in San Francisco. People have left, you know, so there's a different inflation scenario in San Francisco. So I don't really see inflation that much. I see it some, you know, and it's enough to bother us, but it's not like a lower income household in some other part of the country, and where they're seeing maybe 15% or 20% inflation, and their rent goes up 15%, and they spend 60% on their income on rent. You know, that's huge. Suddenly, they don't know what to do, and gasoline doubles. So, well, that's been they have big commutes because they live far away to have the cheaper housing costs, and so they spend a lot of money in gasoline, and suddenly gasoline doubles on them. You know, this is a massive hit to these households. And so I don't think anybody really knows what inflation rates the lower half of the income spectrum are facing. We don't track that. The numbers we have are skewed. So, you know, that we're making policy based on information that's wrong. You know, we're looking at 2% inflation as a goal, when in fact for the lower income levels it may be much higher than 2%, and if it's even there, you know, and now we're looking at the national average in the United States is around 8%. It will probably go over 10% in the next few months. And you know, this is extraordinary inflation, and it's skewed. Yeah, it's skewed to high income people, and the lower income people are paying far more than that. So you know, That's why I said on inflation, I don't think anybody knows. You know, and if you're a lower income household, your inflation is going to be a lot higher than the national average.
Yes. I mean, I just take a look at the provincial legislature here in British Columbia. They just voted themselves a $10,000 retroactive pay raise. How many people have just received $10,000 more a year? Not many.
Yeah, that's always funny, you know, how politicians are the first to give themselves a raise.
Well, I've always said, if minimum wage is so great, why don't politicians work for that? Wolf, yeah, do you think the housing market will ever slow down?
Well, the central banks are certainly wanting them to slow down. The Federal Reserve is specifically targeting the housing market now. Mortgage rates in the United States have spiked. You know, our benchmark 30-year fixed rate mortgage now has an interest rate at over 5%. So that's the highest since 2018. And in fact, it's now probably just moved above that. And so that will be the highest since like 2011. And, that's up by 2 percentage points, over a very short period of time. So when you have housing cost increases of 20% or more, 30% in some cities year over year, plus a 2 percentage point increase in mortgage rate, you get into an instant affordability issue that will take a whole bunch of buyers off the market. So now the mortgage payments aren't going up 20%. They're going up like 40% or more. And so you're removing demand. That's what this is doing. And sellers are, they're still holding on to their properties, but there's still signs now that they're getting a little nervous. And, when they're putting this inventory on the market, it's a shadow inventory. Yeah, these are homes that the owners held on to because they were trying to ride up this huge spike in real estate prices, and that worked. And now they're eventually having to sell them, and they're vacant, you know, and then they've got second and third homes. And so these homes will eventually show up on the market. And that's when the supply shows up. We've seen that in the last housing bust. I mean, supply materializes out of nowhere very quickly. And that's when the sellers, potential sellers, are saying, yeah, we need to put this on the market now. And now it's got this affordability issue that takes a big part of the buyers off the market. And so this is the equation that we're going to look at, I think. But real estate is so slow moving. And the last housing bust, it lasted 4 years. 5 years, really. And the first year of it, with hindsight, it was clear what was happening. But at the time, you know, the real estate industry said, oh, this is, the market is just plateauing at the permanently high level. You know, it's not. And what had happened is that it stalled. You know, it didn't go up anymore. The volume was freezing. The sellers couldn't get the prices they wanted. So there were no sales, not enough sales. The buyers were unwilling to pay those prices, and the market kind of froze over. And you know, when sellers had to sell, when they were forced to sell by the lenders, that's when the forced selling started. That's when they had to cut the prices. And then that happened in the following years, and it ended up, collapsing the housing market. So we won't see a real turnaround, except with hindsight. You know, this doesn't, you can't tell when you're in it. You can't see it. And you don't know. You know, some of the dynamics are changing but the volume starts to drop and high priced homes sit on the market and you get these kinds of issues. But in terms of actually seeing the prices come down in a consistent manner, you know, that turnaround will be visible only with hindsight. And it could take years. You know, last time it took 5 years really to play out. You know, so this is not like the stock market. Even the stock market, you know, you got ups and downs. So you can't really tell where you are until you have some hindsight, and then you can tell. And I think the same is happening in the housing market. We won't know. But the central banks are targeting it, and they're going to succeed. They're going to bring them down, you know, and that's we see that in the mortgage rates that have shot up. The Fed hasn't even really raised interest rates. It's just one little bitty quarter point, you know, and the 30-year fixed rate mortgage has jumped by 2 percentage points. So, yeah, this is a big move, and it's going to impact the housing market for sure.
What's happening in the new and used vehicle markets?
Oh, gosh, the big theme continues to be shortages. And manufacturers are still having trouble getting semiconductors. They're having trouble getting other components. You know, the Ukraine was big in making components for the European car makers. You know, there were wiring harnesses and other things that they made over there that the European automakers suddenly ran out of. I mean, these are all additional problems. The semiconductor shortage was supposed to have been over a long time ago, and it continues to drag on. GM, Ford both announced plant closures in the United States in April. Toyota announced globally that it would cut production in April because of the chip shortages. And, you know, there's other shortages, too, that crop up and that make this whole thing worse. So they're building cars with components missing, and they're going to finish those cars when those components come in. I mean, it's incredibly inefficient operation. So we've got this whole supply chain problem on the new vehicle side, and it's hitting every automaker, some more than others. What has happened in the first quarter is that Toyota became number one, and it for the first time became number one last year in the second quarter, because it still had access to chips, whereas the other automakers didn't. Now Toyota's in the same ballpark. It's having trouble obtaining chips, and its sales are down too, but they're not down as much. And Toyota is selling lots of cars, so sedans, that Ford, GM, and FCA have walked away from, and they stopped making them, except their muscle cars. And, Toyota is very proud of their sedans, and they're selling a lot of them, and they're lower priced, and they get a really good gas mileage, and there's lots of demand, and Toyota's just killing them. So, killing GM and Ford. Toyota's number one, you know. In the first quarter, it looks like that GM and Ford will fall further behind when the chip shortages are resolved, because, Toyota's got cars, and GM and Ford and FCA no longer make cars. And they just walked away from that market a few years ago. And so that's a big thing. Shortage of supply, and the car market is doing pretty good now. So sedans, you know, people want to buy them to get better gas mileage and cost less. And the big three U.S. automakers are not making them anymore. Tesla is still making them and doing well with its Model 3, and as are Toyota, many other automakers. So this is a big change, and I've always lambasted it, and now we're seeing it come to haunt the big three automakers. We have these shortages, and we have huge price increases. We don't really know what demand is at those prices if we had full inventories, you know. So people go to the car lot and want to buy something, and there's nothing there to buy, and they have to order, and they have to wait for months to get it, and that's the situation they're now in. They're paying over sticker a lot of times to get the vehicle. So it's that kind of market we're still facing. The problem is supposed to have been resolved long ago, and it continues to dog the industry, and it will for the rest of the year. I don't think it's going to get resolved pretty soon. I mean, it's going to drag on and could drag on into 2023. On the used car side, we have plenty of supply. Prices have spiked, so there is now a limit on demand at these sky-high prices. There's not oversupply, but there's plenty of supply. But there are enough people who are not buying at those prices. Now, used car prices in the United States on the retail level have shot up by 40% year over year. There's some resistance now on these prices, and there's a little bit of a dip in volume. There's a little bit of a dip at the wholesale side now, so we can see that there is some pricing resistance cropping up. But, I don't really understand why prices have shot up, because there was never any shortage of used vehicles. There's always, plenty of supply. And when prices shot up, it was psychological. And customers paid it, dealers charged it, dealers paid those prices at the wholesale auctions, and it cycled through the whole system. And it was one of those phenomenal experiences in life. You know, I've never seen this before. I've worked the car business for a long time, and I've never seen this before, where the whole chain of buyers just pays whatever, you know, from all the way through. You know, the customer, the retail customer pays whatever. The dealer then buys it. The wholesale auction pays whatever. You know, it just cycles through. And you have this ridiculous price increase. And even though there's no shortage, there's plenty of used cars on dealer lots. So you go on there and you pick something out you like, and you got plenty of choices, you know, and then you pay this huge price. Yeah, this is something that I thought couldn't last, and it continues to last. It's surprising me every month how it just hangs in there. This is a psychological shift I just cannot fully explain. But that's how inflation works. That's a typical sign of inflation, how it gets entrenched in the economy when you could avoid having to buy. I mean, people don't really have to buy a new vehicle or a used vehicle. They can just wait. They can drive what they have. Most people can drive what they have for another year or two, but they're not doing it. You know, they want to buy, and they're willing to pay these prices. And so this is just a phenomenon that was unthinkable until a couple of years ago. You know, this just I still can't get my arms around it. It just baffles me, and it's completely unnecessary. You know, people could just stop buying these cars and stop buying new cars, and the prices will come down, and the inventories would fill up, and all the manufacturers would catch up, and the chip makers would catch up. You know, so the demand would collapse. So that's not the case. So far, you know, people are buying, paying ridiculous prices, and are buying.
Is the U.S. electric vehicle market heating up?
Yeah, they had the same problem everybody else has, that they can't make enough. And the legacy automakers are now coming out with their own models, like Ford and GM and others, you know, and Jaguar and Volkswagen has a whole bunch. But they can't make enough. They sell everyone they make, and the long waiting list to get them. So, you know, demand is really strong. The supply is handicapped by the chip shortages. And the legacy automakers, you know, they just started doing them, so they really haven't gotten their supply chains in place. Tesla's, you know, has been doing it for a long time, and so their supply chains are pretty solid on EVs. You know, the Ford and GM and the others just started, and so they're still trying to glue together their supply chains for the battery technology and for all the other stuff. So the volumes are just really low from the legacy automakers. I mean, they're selling everything they make, but they can't make very much. Tesla is now just today opening its factory. The grand opening is today in Texas, that big plant there, and it's opening a plant in Germany in April. So it will put more EV vehicle supply on the market if it source enough parts and components and chips to make them. The legacy automakers are retooling their plants to make EVs, and that's happening, but it's happening slowly, and everybody's handicapped with supply shortages.
How much longer can the U.S. dollar remain the dominant global reserve currency?
Well, I should put a date on my calendar here. See how long it's going to last. Right now, so for the last figure we got from the IMF was for the fourth quarter of last year, and that came out a week ago, the dollar's share as a reserve currency was down to 58.8%. So that was the lowest in 26 years. And a reserve currency means that central banks and other state institutions are holding financial assets. So government bonds or corporate bonds and similar instruments denominated in that currency. So, for example, the Bank of Japan's holdings of U.S. treasuries, contributes to the U.S. dollar as foreign, as a global reserve currency. Yeah, it's foreign exchange holdings by other central banks. And So we're looking at paper assets that these central banks are holding denominated in these currencies. So in the, for the U.S., it's the dollar. But, yeah, the second largest reserve currency is the euro, and it has a share of around 20%, been around 20% for a long time. And the euro was supposed to be on parity with the dollar when it, you know, when it first was pitched. That was the, that, you know, over 20 years ago, that was the goal, to have a currency that's on par with the dollar as a reserve currency, but also as a trading currency and as a financing currency. And the euro has done very well as a trading currency, largely because of the huge global trade that the eurozone does with the rest of the world and its trade surplus that it has. And it has done pretty well as a financing currency, but it's as a reserve currency, it's still only 20%. And what stalled it was the euro debt crisis that blew up in 2009, 2010 through 2012, and that made central banks aware of the structural weakness of the euro, in that it is a currency that is supranational. no country really controls that. So you cannot print yourself out of trouble like the United States or Canada can. And you have a central bank there that doesn't belong to any particular country. And that became a weakness, and Greece actually defaulted on its government bonds. Greece being a Eurozone member, so it had Euro government bonds outstanding, and it defaulted on them, and it restructured them and gave its investors a big haircut, 60%. And that taught everybody a lesson about the weakness of the Euro, a structural weakness, you know. And had Greece kept its own currency, it could have printed itself out of trouble and wouldn't have had to default. It would have created some inflation, but it wouldn't have had to default, and with the euro, it had to default. And so the euro never went past 20% seriously in terms of the share of global reserve currency. So now the yen is the number three, and then the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar, and some of the other currencies are further down, and they combine a half a share. The Chinese renminbi, now that represents the second largest economy in the world, and it has a minuscule share of 2% of as a global reserve currency, and that is bound to change eventually. But the renminbi is not freely convertible yet, and the capital controls in place, and it's a good trading currency, but it's not freely convertible, and in terms of the renminbi denominated assets, and so it can't really become a fully fledged global reserve currency until it's fully convertible, and that's not happening anytime soon. And I think it would be a good thing, if the currency of the second largest economy becomes a larger reserve currency. And it should happen. That's something that would be good for the global economy, I think. And I don't think it would hurt the U.S. economy, but it would diminish further the share of the dollar as a global reserve currency. Now we're at 58.8%, so we're not that far away from being less than 50%. Now 50% means that the other currencies combined have a larger share, larger than the dollar by itself, and that already, that's kind of a sound barrier. The dollar went through that in the past. This happened in the 1970s, late 1970s, when there was a huge bout of inflation in the United States, and with double-digit inflation in the, for years, the Fed chose to just really not seriously chase after it, and then it chased after it, but ineffectually. And it wasn't until the early 1980s that the Fed actually cracked down successfully on inflation. And then it took another 10. By that time, the dollar share was down to 46%. And it's the European currencies and the yen and other currencies that took the rest. The European currencies at that time included the Deutsche Mark and the French franc and some of the others. And so they partially replaced the dollar as as reserve currencies. And then it took another 10 years for the dollar to recover. And so now we're back there. You know, we've got another big bout of inflation. We've got the Fed, talking about cracking down, but not really cracking down yet. They're gonna chase this inflation for a long time. You know, it's gonna take years. They're gonna be behind the curve. They're gonna stay behind the curve. They're gonna crack down, but just a little bit. Inflation will keep getting away from them. And I think that will diminish the dollar's role. Now we've got other countries in the same situation, obviously. So huge bout of inflation breaking out in the Eurozone and in Germany, you know, in Spain, in France, in other countries. So, you ask yourself, well, what is going to replace the dollar as a reserve currency? And you know, right now the dollar is still a fairly clean shirt, maybe the cleanest shirt out there. So its decline as reserve currency will be very slow. I don't think we see a rapid collapse. And the ascent of the Chinese renminbi will be very, very slow. I think we're talking 2 decades before we will reach 10% or 15%, that range, you know. So these are very slow-moving events. But I cannot imagine that the dollar will retain a share larger than 50% for many more decades. I think we'll see next 10 years or so, maybe 15 years, the dollar will probably be at the 50% level or lower.
Are the prices of gasoline and diesel a predictor of recessions?
Well, they don't help. Let me put it this way. They represent a strain on household budgets at the lower income levels. But the last time we had a big spike in gasoline and diesel prices, so that was in 2008. But the recession then, the Great Recession, wasn't caused by the fuel prices. You know, it was caused by the collapse of the housing market and by the collapse of the banking system when Lehman went bankrupt and the whole economy froze. And, you know, GM went bankrupt and Chrysler went bankrupt and the whole auto supply chains went bankrupt. This was a credit financial crisis. And it was triggered originally by a big housing bubble that had imploded. And you know, with all the mortgages going bad, or a big part of the mortgages going bad. And, people started losing their jobs and couldn't buy cars anymore, and that's really what triggered the massive recession that we got out of that, or demand just collapsed. And high fuel prices won't do that. You know, they'll lower growth, they'll eat a little bit into budgets, you know, but they don't cause that kind of collapse in demand that we saw. And the high fuel prices will people shift away from eventually, it hasn't happened yet, but eventually will happen from doing things that cost fuel. So they will drive less. If they have two vehicles, they will prioritize their more efficient vehicle. If they don't have to go somewhere, they might not go there. They might cancel a driving vacation that they had, and instead of, they might go someplace, just stay there. Yeah, there's a lot of ways consumers can cut back on driving. They can carpool more. They can use mass transit. And we see that every time gas prices reach a certain level, you know, there's this demand destruction going on. And that's how consumers react. But it's not enough to trigger, by itself, it's not enough to trigger a recession in the United States. We're not that dependent on gasoline prices anymore, you know, in terms of our consumption patterns. So I don't think it will trigger a recession. It might take a little bit of growth out of the growth pattern, but it won't be enough to throw the U.S. into a recession.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Bob Hoy, Hilliard Macbeth, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from American Manganese CEO and President Larry Ray. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more
This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Larry Ray, CEO and President of American Manganese. Welcome back to Company Showcase, Larry.
Glad to be on it.
Larry, the demonstration plant for American Manganese where you're, trying to recycle products, maybe explain to us what that demonstration plant does and how's it going so far?
Well, it's, I finally was able to get down there and have a visit, and, I see it's, coming together. It's, a lot larger than I envisioned from the drawings. And I mean, I'm talking about a couple of pieces as big as our pilot plant. Now, all these are innovative pieces of intellectual property that we are working on, and it's coming together, and it really excited me to see the high tech that's involved in this plant and the size of this plant. You know, everybody wants to see me do a timeline and everything else. I don't know how you can do a timeline when you're designing and building the plant out, and if there's a small piece missing, you have a delay. But anyway, I was really excited about the progress that's being made. Looking at that thing, I think if our shareholders were able to all visit the plant, they'd be very, very much appeased. They would, they'd see that, hey, this thing is not some Mickey Mouse deal. You know, our pilot plant, which took time to build and everything else because it was a new innovation too, is only about the size of two pieces of equipment on the demonstration plant. And some of that equipment is dwarfs the pilot plant. So, we can't have everything. People want me to put out timelines again on when we're going to have the plant finished. Well, I won't put out timelines, because I don't have any control over something that may be missing or something that may have gotten broken and has to be replaced. So, putting out timelines is just a way of cutting your throat, the company's throat, because you can't make a timeline that you don't control. And, if you can't control it, certainly COVID controls a lot of our timeline. And, you have to go with the flow. You have to go with everything else. But if you look at the innovation that's being made, the high tech look of this plant, and it's not going to be all hidden behind, sheets of steel that, you see most plants are. This one here will be out in the open. And why not? It's in our patent. And we don't expect anybody would be foolish enough to copy the patent. And if they did, well, there's ways of getting to them. You can lose everything by encroaching on somebody's patent. But anyway, let's stick to the positive. The positive is that these pieces of equipment, are. Like even the filtration, there's two filters, and you look at those, they're very high-tech looking, they're very large, they take up a lot of room, and it's just got to all come together. We've got water testing equipment in there that can take it down to high purities of water, so that we don't contaminate the flow of the leaching. So it's, there's a lot of things to think about. There's a lot of things to think about when you're building a plant like this. So So I'm sorry, guys, if you're disappointed, but I'm not. And I don't think anybody that sees it would be disappointed. So, you know, the most recent generation of pieces of equipment that are being put together in each module is, you know, is really staggering. You know, I was certainly flabbergasted. And, you know, I've been around process plants most of my life. And they're not like mining plants. The mining plants all kind of have the same look, ball mills, sag mills, flotation circuits. It's, you know, everything that they have, thickeners, is, you know, some of the things that we have. But they all have that same look and touch and feel. And, you know, this one here won't. This one here will be a showcase piece of equipment. And it'll just be an example of what the eventual commercial plant will look like. And we can't build the commercial plant until we get this one completed so that we know exactly what we need. And Cometco are doing a bang-up job. Cometco have a very strong reputation out there. Anybody smearing them is, you know, because if they're smearing us, saying that we're lying about what's going on, then, you know, they're smearing Cometco. Cometco's an arm's length contractor, and that's the way we wanted it, and that's the way it's going to be, and that's the way it is. So, you know, come on, guys. You know, let's get behind the project and see what's going to happen. I expect the venom that comes my way, because a lot of investors will always blame somebody else for their mistakes. And their mistake was not buying the stock when it was a way down, because all this stuff was fairly well known when we were at 20 cents and 30 cents. And it's very well known now that we're at 65 to 75. So, hey, I think that... you know, you should take a second look at it, evaluate your portfolio. We've been transparent. We had a write-up on that, and that write-up was nothing. We never had one iota of information that went into that except it was out in the public. So, you know, I like that piece. That piece was something that we could actually send out to our investors, because we didn't have a hand in it. And it was, you know, we went through it, and as all we did was report the press releases in a sequence that showed the advancements of the company. Don't forget that we've got those 7 or 8 patents, and we've got other patents pending. So it's not like we're sitting in a back room somewhere smoking a cigar and BSing each other. We're basically trying to put a good product into the hands of the public and have something that's going to work for the environment. Nobody wants to talk about what the environment is. Somebody wrote me a letter and said these guys get 95%. And what's 95%? Well, you take 1 million pounds, that's 50,000 pounds of waste. And we want to have it's close to 0 pounds of waste on a sustainable closed-circuit pilot plant, or demonstration plant, I should say, and eventually a commercial plant. So, you know, I was very excited about that. I've been knocked down a bit, but, you know, I'm still excited about it, and no matter what happens, I'm 100% behind this project.
For people unfamiliar with American Manganese, what does the company do, and how can they trade it and find out more information about it?
Well, the best place to go for information is the company website. And there's all the information that's out there. It's all very transparent. And, it's, you know, everything that you need to know about the company is out there. And, you know, far as investing, that's up to you to do your own due diligence and do the investing. And, you know, it's, you can't blame the management for the fact that we are in a bear market. You know, it's not a bull market out there. We have a bull day. We have two down days. We have an up day, and we have another down day, or we have two up days, and we have another down day. You know, it's an unpredictable market. It's very volatile, and you know, you just gotta stand your ground. If you like your investment, like most people say they do, then they shouldn't be wobbled. You know, I mean, because they can go and get the actual truth off the site. So that's you know, and we're there to actually to bring a solution to the environment. The environment is important. I mean, we want a sustainable closed circuit solution that puts very little or nothing back into the environment. And that's what we're achieving, as our results are telling us. And all we can say is that, you know, I'm happy to be working with Cometco. I've been working with Cometco now for, what, oh, God, close to 15 years. And I found them to be the most stellar and the most advanced and the most innovative company out there when it comes to something. They can put the mass balances together. They can say, we think we can do that. And if you think that they can do that, you put your money behind them and let them go to work. So anyway, Jim, that's kind of the way we are. And I'm hoping that next podcast will have a nice photo of a piece of equipment that's out there that shows a lot of high tech value, a lot of innovation. And, you know, I would hope that would, you know, whet the cockles of the hearts of the investors. So, you know, we got a lot of investors that do have belief in the project. And, you know, they're encouraging to the management. And so we just want to keep that circuit going.
Again, Larry, where are you traded? How can people get more information?
Well, we're traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the symbol AMY. We're traded on the QB Exchange under the symbol AMYZF, and we're traded in Frankfurt under the symbol 2AM. Our symbol, I just went through the symbols. The website is AmericanManganeseInc.com, where you can do all of your due diligence. It's all there in front of you, and you know, you can phone the company at 778-574-4444. You know, you can email me at LREAUGH@AMYMN.com, or Zarco for that matter. And, you know, I see a big change coming in the market, and I see a big, a lot of, banners for, American Manganese coming up.
Larry, thank you so much for the update.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Larry Ray, CEO and President of American Manganese. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on April 8th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.